And I tell people this, if a special prosecutor went after your life for the last 40 years, not you in particular, but anybody, I think they could dredge up accusations. So I'm absolutely against it. I think it's a miscarriage of justice. We should not have special prosecutors going after one person. And if we get this way, and if we're going to prosecute people and put them in jail for campaign finance violations, we're going to become a banana republic, where they have every president gets prosecuted and everybody gets thrown in jail when they're done with office.
That was Senator Rand Paul on Meet the Press this weekend in a widely circulated and widely criticized interview with Chuck Todd. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Podcast, Editor's Roundtable Edition. I am Matt Welch, joined by my crack team of legal analysts and Rand Paul whisperers, Catherine Mangu Ward, Peter Suderman, and Nick Gillespie. A fine, fresh morning to you.
Happy Monday.
Hey, Matt.
Quick reminder for people out there, please subscribe to us, do the rate and review thing over at Apple Podcasts, and you can also subscribe to us at Spotify. So we are all still digesting a trifecta. That's fine, Catherine, right? You digest
a
trifecta of
you could have gone with digesting the three-course meal of. See, that would have worked.
The prefix.
You have extend it, and then it loses all of its steam. Trump, Russia, Mueller stories, court filings on Friday afternoon, three of them. Two of them were sentencing memos for Michael, not Stephen Cohen, who is Trump's former Mr. Fix-It lawyer guy, plus a Mueller memo about the lying lies of former campaign manager Paul Manafort. Two big headlines coming out of the Friday dump are that individual one, meaning President Trump, stands accused in federal court now of directing and helping to conceal knowing campaign finance violation via the hush money payoffs of porn actress Stormy Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal, and that Cohen's confessed criminal lie to Congress about negotiations over possible Trump-Moscow deal were abetted by unnamed members of the administration, which was characterized by our pal Ken Popat White over at The Atlantic as that's explosive and potentially impeachable if Trump himself is implicated. That's the best Reader's Digest version I can do of all the weekend stuff. Suderman, I wanted to start with you, but refracting this through Rand Paul's take on it, which is a pretty interesting interview that I recommend everybody check out in full out there. It's kind of the most respectable libertarian argument against the Mueller investigation in general. So is Rand Paul onto something when he characterizes the campaign finance violations here as an error in paperwork, or when he makes statements like, I don't understand why building a hotel in Moscow would be illegal, and that kind of skepticism?
So I don't think he's exactly right on all of those things, although he has a partial point about the special prosecutors, and that if a special prosecutor was given a nearly unlimited federal budget to look into anybody's life, they could probably find something, and perhaps in some cases, even with some pretty decent people, a lot of things. And I think that there's a real truth to that. That said, The campaign finance violation that has been alleged, that is in question in here, it was not an error. It wasn't just a little mistake where you forgot to turn in a form on time or turn in a form at all or filled it out wrong. The campaign finance violation was when Trump, according to the documents, directed Michael Cohen to pay off someone who he had slept with. And in order to maintain this person's silence, it was done pretty clearly intentionally. It appears to have been done. There's reason to believe, I should say, that this was not the only time that he did it. It also happened with Karen McDougal. That was an intentional way of, I think of hiding information from the public during a political campaign. And similarly with the Russia stuff. Rand Paul says that it probably shouldn't be a crime to build a hotel in Moscow. I think I can buy that. I can agree with that. But what Trump did wasn't build a hotel in Moscow. He'd never actually built it. What he did was as far as we can tell, he and his campaign staff lied about the possibility that they were still working on it. And again, I'll go back to something I said last week, was that Trump said neither he nor anyone on his campaign had any business dealings with Russia because he understood. This is Donald Trump said that he understood that to have those dealings with Russia would pose a conflict. So Trump knew that this was a conflict and with the aid of Michael Cohen hid that from the American public. So even if you don't think it should be a crime, this is a lie. This is a lie intended to cover up something that Trump himself understood was shady.
Nick, Trump, again, this morning is using the phrase witch hunt, which appears to be his kind of main or final line of defense against all this. A person that you spent this morning with, Judge Andrew Napolitano, I'm not saying that in confidence. That was in a public meeting. He has rather firmly made the opposite argument. Like, no, this is not a witch hunt. This is not a fishing expedition. This is serious. And those around the president or those in the White House who call it as such are degrading their own position by maintaining that. As someone, I think I could characterize you as being somewhat skeptical about parts of this investigation. Where do you, first, did Judge, you and Judge talk about this at all this morning in a way that you can reveal exclusively, or can you kind of chart your own course between the Rand Paul take and the Judge Napolitano take?
No, the judge and I were talking about kind of what it means to be libertarian in a in the contemporary political context. So it wasn't about this.
Although just hopeless despair.
Was yeah, part. Pretty much. You know, it was just like, how, you know, but on his
so
new show on Fox
there.
Nation, the streaming service. but I think the, you know, part of what the judge is talking about is the case that's coming out of the Southern District of New York against Cohen, and Trump is involved in that. And that seems to be legally on more on firmer ground about stuff. I find the anything having to do with campaign finance law is obviously a kind of a scam. Campaign finance law exists primarily, as in my understanding of it, to screw over people who don't already have political power, and then to create an infinite number of kind of mousetraps or glue traps for people to get caught up in after the fact. So I am completely sympathetic to the idea that anything that is talking about campaign finance stuff is just kind of horseshit. Having said that, I do think that the way that Trump has talked about stuff, he and the people around him have misremembered, have lied, have perjured themselves, or will perjure themselves. And again, in general, I find this kind of stuff disturbing because most of the big problems come, or seem to be less about what Trump, may or may not have done. And it's not just him, but people in this situation where you're always going to end up getting caught in a lie whenever you talk to a federal investigator, whether it's a prosecutor or the FBI or anything like that. They are trained in order to do that. And then that ends up typically becoming what really goes on. Are people saying, and I agree with Peter that it's messed up. If Trump said, no, we stopped contact with Russia talking about the Moscow building because we realized that after a certain point, it's a problem. But is this what a presidency rises and falls on? Do people seriously believe, beyond their own Trump derangement syndrome, that a president is going to completely, kind of screw over the country and all of our best interests based on a real estate deal? I don't think that was particularly credible, when Bill Clinton was being accused of it. I don't think it is now. None of it speaks well to Trump. None of it speaks well to the way that federal prosecutors do stuff, but it still seems to me to be, there's a big picture out there which has to do with things like war, wars that have not been officially or constitutionally declared, about, debt that is not even spiraling out of control, has already kind of, reached, the ability of escape velocity, et cetera. This kind of stuff does not keep me.
I would just add that the real estate deal in question, known as the Moscow Project, was not just a conventional, typical hotel being built in a major foreign city. There reportedly was a discussion of giving Vladimir Putin a $50 million penthouse as part of this deal. So it was pretty, if this reporting is accurate, it was pretty heavily tied up in Russian politics.
Well, and of course, any development in a place like Russia in that context is going to have that. So, you know, again, I'm not saying this isn't, you know,
scheme. Not sure any is going to have a.
Does Vladimir Putin have a $50 million penthouse on top of every hotel in Russia?
That's actually, yeah, it's one of the most remarkable things about Russia. It's, wow. Yeah, it's astounding.
Catherine, building on some of what Nick was saying here and also what Peter was saying. So after the election, after Trump's in office, Hope Hicks, who's then his top spokesperson, said regarding Russian contacts that during the campaign, they never happened. There was no communication between the campaign and any foreign entity during the campaign. President Trump himself said in February 2017, nope, nobody that I know of was in contact with the Russians. And I have nothing to do with Russia. To the best of my knowledge, no person that I deal with does. We now know that 14 people involved closely with the Trump campaign and organization administration had contacts with Russia, specifically about possible ways that people and entities in Russia could help out Trump during the campaign. And two of those are Trump's oldest children. So there's the okay, yeah, they lie about it all the time and everybody lies kind of element to that. But are you troubled at all in one line of argument against this type of stuff, which is this, that the fact that the Trump people were constantly lying about, I mean, just constantly lying about whatever context they might have had with Russia, was well known by people in Russia. And in fact, in one kind of spectacular case, was abetted. Michael Cohen's testimony, which he has since pled guilty to lying about and now testified in open court, that there was a circulation of this lie, the prepared lie, among people in the administration. That lie was confirmed as being true by a spokesman for the Kremlin for a while. So they were like abetting the lie back then. Does that concern you that there's basically some kind of blackmailable thing hanging over an administration, which itself is more troubling than a garden variety lie?
That was a lot of question.
That's just one question, though.
It's true. Yeah. So, like, this story was confirmed by a spokesman for the Kremlin is the same thing as saying, like, this is a lie, right? So I think in some ways there's some historical layers there. Yeah. I mean, you know, as I've said many times on this podcast, I always favor the incompetence explanation over the conspiracy explanation. And I don't think that that should be undervalued here. There's clearly incompetence going on as well. I think early in the campaign in particular, this was a campaign that was not staffed up by top level political operatives. This was people, to say the least, this was people who were kind of winging it. And, you know, if reports are to be believed, didn't really think there would be a lot of reckoning to be had because they didn't really think that Trump was going to win. And so I think at least some of these violations were genuinely inadvertent, or people knew that they were sort of on the edge of appropriateness, but they just figured it would come out in the wash. And, you know, this is the Rand Paul point, is if you insist on every technicality, everyone has places where they have screwed up, either out of ignorance or out of, a hope that they would not be caught. However, there is a point where we cross into conspiracy, and I am inclined to say that we are now in the conspiracy zone, although I would not still say that we are in the conspiracy that cuts to the heart of our democracy zone. And I think that's like a weird turf to hold down. Like, I understand it's like, this is very bad and violates a bunch of our laws, and also perjury is bad, and definitely a bunch of people lied, and weirdly their lies were covered up for them by the Kremlin, which can never be good. And yes, the real estate deal in Moscow was very entangled. However, this strikes me as worse than garden variety corruption at the low level, but not so bad as to merit a total breakdown of our political process and the consumption of like 80% of our news time for a year and a half.
Peter, to that point, I think this is hard to kind of untangle, but it feels like we're getting to a place where we are now seeing evidence of a conspiracy based on incompetence. Which is to say, they were so ham-handed about the way that they did it that there's now breadcrumbs of a conspiracy. But when we usually use the word conspiracy, when we're not talking about conspiracy theorists, we imagine a level of sophistication. So are we punishing Trump world for being unsophisticated?
I don't think so.
But if we were, that would be okay, just to chime in here. Like, it's cool to punish a president for not being sophisticated.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's right. If you make it to the White House and you take some of those people with you or allow some of those folks, as Cohen did, to profit off the fact that you came to the White House. Cohen made something like $4 million in contracts where he provided basically no services or value just by getting companies to pay him because he had supposed access to the president. If you make it to that point, then like incompetence, competence, almost, I won't say it doesn't matter at all, but it's definitely a secondary factor. Are we punishing them for incompetence? No, I don't think so. In particular, in the case of Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort made tens of millions of dollars throughout his career, basically by working as a political operative for totalitarian, authoritarian leaders across the world. He knew what he was doing. He was Donald Trump's, he was running Donald Trump's campaign. And so when you combine the fact that part of what Manafort is reported to have done in the new court filings is lie about his communications with and connections with a Russian intelligence agent named Konstantin Kilimnik, which is just such a like a John Le Carre, like perfect Russian source name. But like that he had that Manafort, who was indebted to Russian oligarchs, who had sent emails saying, well, look, I want to help make myself whole because now I've got this position with the Trump presidency. That wasn't incompetence. That was something else. That was a guy who knew exactly what he was doing.
Well, and this is, I mean, that type of sort of self-dealing while also working in the service of an administration is exactly the sort of thing that campaign finance law is designed to prevent, right? I mean, this idea that, okay, even if you manage to kind of check all the legal boxes and file all the right paperwork, like the idea that when you take a bunch of money from someone to get something that you want, you will then be inclined to look favorably on that someone's requests or interests. Like, that's why people want to get money out of politics. And I do understand that impulse. And I think we're just seeing it in its sort of most cartoonish form here.
But I think just,
I actually don't think that that's what, the Manafort stuff is about. That's more about the idea that the foreign government,
right,
or
so
foreign
in this case,
are going to get
in this,
this
case,
or that.
The entity that wants consideration is a foreign government. And so that adds another layer. But I think this underlying dynamic, which we see in some of the Manafort stuff, especially of like, hey, you and I go a ways back, we're financially entangled, let's make a deal, right? Like that general impulse on the part of people with power is the thing that people who advocate campaign finance.
But don't we, in most contexts, we say that, that it actually doesn't quite
work. Right, so obviously what I was going to say is that like my impulse here and always is to say, listen, somebody like Paul Manafort should not be in a position to offer much, right? Like that's how you solve this problem, is that you don't give the Paul Manaforts of the world anything to give away. You don't give them a special consideration to have on the U.S. government side. And I think, that's just a broader problem of like government should be small and special favors should be rare to non-existent.
If the Mueller report has confirmed one thing, it's that Trump's choice of personnel is not exactly A+. He doesn't hire the best people.
But again, I mean, does that mean taking the Rand Paul argument, which is not my own, but are we going to live in a world where we will have special prosecutors who will be able to inflict maximum punishments based on the non-A-plusness of the appointees, Nick?
Yeah, we already live in that world. And I think that part of, an unspoken reality here, and it doesn't mean that the cases go away or anything, but it's that if Hillary Clinton had won the election, as everybody expected her to, including the Russians, including Donald Trump, including Hope Hicks, Paul Manafort's, Russian handlers, whatever, none of this would be being talked about, and we might be talking about John Podesta and Tony Podesta instead. Tony Podesta, who's kind of a Paul Manafort type character. And I don't want to, one of the things that bothers me about kind of libertarian discourse in general is that we end up being kind of both personnel and policy nihilists. So it's, what do you expect? Of course, government is incompetent, it's corrupt, it's terrible, and you get the worst people, in that kind of world for all sorts of reasons. So I don't want to fully go there, but it does seem to me, the role of special prosecutors and the role of independent counsels, at least since, Watergate and post-Watergate, is to really end up coming up with situations that are less dire than they seem to be. And we spend a lot of time talking about this rather than the policy stuff that is actually more important. And I realize this itself is a form of whataboutism, why care about what Donald Trump or Eric Trump did as long as the national debt is $21 trillion. But it does seem to me that the way that this investigation and the set of investigations are playing out is that it's really much more about politics, and it's much more about kind of like hamstringing and handicapping whoever is in the White House than actually coming up with anything that is going to substantively change the direction.
So I think,
but as a critic of the executive power, isn't there something okay if we're going
to
have
because this doesn't do anything to rein in,
you just said handicapping the White House.
No, it makes it politically. It's not, that isn't Trump's problem. A bunch of executive orders he signed have gone into business. Other ones have been challenged by the courts. It's not clear to me if we want to whittle down, the imperial presidency, we need to be taking a different tack than just merely saying every president is, the minute that they get into power, they're going to have some kind of special prosecutor, independent counsel, locked onto their ankles. And then we'll see what happens.
Two quick points, semi-rebuttals of that. One is that the biggest hit that the imperial presidency has taken in our lifetimes, by which I mean yours and mine, Nick's, not the whippersnappers, was Watergate. And Watergate was a abuse of power investigation. And afterwards, people were shocked to discover how widespread it was. And they whittled down for a while. It got reversed. Like that was a body blow. And the other thing, and I'll throw this to Peter, you make whatever point you're going to make anyways.
I'll do that, Matt.
This started off, as far as my brain has memory here, as a there's two investigations, but one of them was a counterintelligence investigation opened up in 2016. And the reason why there's a special counsel here is, okay, yes, sure, you still have an ongoing administration, but you also had an ongoing investigation, one that was implicated, or which the sitting attorney general of the United States was part of that story, and so he had to step aside. That's why you triggered a special counsel.
Are we any closer to finding out whether or not Russia threw the election?
I have no idea.
I mean, because isn't that what the actual national interest here is? Is whether had some major impact on the election? Whether or not Donald Trump is a scummy businessman by scummy businessmen.
I think the operative question is not whether they threw it, whether they attempted to, and who they worked with in that attempt. I think that's the operative question.
I was going to say what Matt just said, which is, one of the big criticisms here is that there is no smoking gun for collusion. I think that's right. There's no smocking gun. Smock, 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 as a pet tiger in Calvin and Hobbes once said. Don't knock my smock or I'll clean your clock. Anyway, there's a whole week of Calvin and Hobbes strips about Hobbes loving his smock. Mueller has actually advanced this case and not just a bunch of side stuff. And yes, there's a bunch of shady business deals that are basically unrelated to Russia that he's uncovered, that Cohen was involved in, and other stuff that Manafort was involved in. And yes, he's proven or seems to have provided strong evidence that Donald Trump was involved in campaign finance violations. But what we also found here are more than a dozen individuals in Trump's orbit related to the campaign having contact with Russian nationals, with in some cases with people who are understood to be Russian intelligence agents. We have Trump lying about a potentially incredibly lucrative deal in Russia, a real estate deal that was that is reportedly connected to the very top of Russian politics. We have Trump's son going to a meeting in Trump Tower for the explicit stated on the record. This is not in dispute at all. Intention of getting dirt on the Hillary Clinton campaign. And we now have some suggestion, which they didn't get.
Fully clear that that's
they
illegal,
didn't get.
Right?
But we also have now some additional suggestion that Trump knew about that meeting and has lied about it. They have actually taken us closer to understanding what the connections were between Trump and Russia, the Trump campaign and Russia. And I think there's actually been real movement made on that front. This is not just they're not just sort of picking off random crimes here.
What's going to happen? Yeah, but what's going to happen? First off, we know that Russia tried to influence the election because, of course, they did. And of course, America tries to influence elections, including Russian elections, which is one of the reasons why Putin had such a hard on against Hillary Clinton. What's going to come out of this is regulation of Facebook for all sorts of bullshit reasons about, oh, you know, they're not doing enough to stop Russian troll accounts that had no effect on anybody's voting patterns. We're going to have a weakening of things like Julian Assange might and WikiLeaks might have known about, you know, where the documents, the hacked DNC documents come from. So we're going to get an eating away of the idea that unless you're the New York Times or the Washington Post, that you're actually a news media organization that gets First Amendment protection. I don't see, you know, and again, I'm not questioning any of this. What I see is coming out of this whole cloud are a bunch of negative outcomes that end up restricting the individual freedom of Americans in ways that do not in any way, shape, or form advance the cleanliness and the hygiene of the next election or of campaign finance laws or of anything that's going to do anything other than kind of, be payback for the fact that Hillary Clinton ran the world's worst presidential campaign.
I think they
lost.
Give us a little bit of information, maybe even a lot of information, about the current sitting president, who we should know as much as we can about, who will be up for election in 2020, and who a majority of sitting Republicans in Congress have supported.
And at the very least, I think I don't think it's an efficient way to get there, but I do think the prospect of the eternal presidential in sort of independent investigator or broad-based investigation, like in theory, that would incentivize people running for president to not do the sort of thing to trigger this sort of investigation. Now, maybe in practice, the investigation happens no matter what. Maybe in theory and in practice, people say it's worth the risk of not getting, you know, it's worth the risk because I might not get caught. But I basically agree with your intuition, Nick, but I think, you know, this is all just burning rubber. Though this is all just sort of noise is not quite right. Like people are changing their behavior right now based on this. Now maybe they're not changing it in a productive way or a healthy way, but at least somebody is being like, you know what? Let me just not get entangled in a real estate deal because I might want to run for president.
Or let me just not run for president because I just want to build this hotel.
Both of which would be fine outcomes. More
but
hotels, fewer
presidents.
I'm not
worried about that because the people who are going to run for president are not bound by any, you know, laws of personality type that any of us on this in this conversation can understand. What is going to happen is that social media is going to be regulated. The government is going to call for more kinds of disclaimers and public pronouncements filings of
this
and
that
paperwork for people who want to front their office. And the press is going to be narrowed in its limit, or it's going to be defined in a way that makes it harder for the next WikiLeaks to actually leak stuff that everybody agrees is legitimate and was worth knowing about. I mean, because for me, to be quite honest, whether or not Donald Trump is a piece of shit, whether or not Vladimir Putin is in on rake-offs, whether or not the Trump spawn, are hideous people, is less important to me, than what the leaked emails from the DNC, revealed, which is that you had an operation that was supposedly you know, is supposed to facilitate a clean, you know, nominating process of a candidate for a major party, and in fact was completely in the tank and was doing everything that it could to screw over an insurgent candidate. And I hate Bernie Sanders. I think his politics are worse. I think his policies are worse than Hillary Clinton's. But I really, you know, I think that's something that's worth talking about is like, what the hell is, who, how is the RNC going to be acting going forward to screw over an insurgent candidate who might actually be semi-libertarian? I think it's worth keeping the focus on some of the stuff that, you know, is at the root of all of these investigations, but people have shown absolutely no interest in
this. I'm just very excited for the 2020 Democratic primary debates, which will feature 100 Democratic senators, including
shouting.
Some, yes, I know there are not 100 Democratic senators, but they're going to find
senators,
some extra ones.
They'll be extras.
And put them on stage on CNN, and it's going to be delightful.
Speaking of that, and speaking of Trump's hideous spawn, Donald Trump Jr. was recently in a Twitter scrap, because that's the world that we live in, with darling new progressive congressperson Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I think he made some forwarded some Twitter meme about how socialism leads to people eating their dogs, which is totally true, by the way. And she responded to he by saying, "I have noticed that Junior here has a habit of posting nonsense about me whenever the Mueller investigation heats up. Please keep it coming, Junior. It's definitely a very, very large brain idea to troll a member of a body that will have subpoena power in a month. Have fun," says Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And she was hammered all weekend over this. Both Peter and Catherine have written recently about this new is it kind of the new Trump figure on the left, kind of. Everyone is obsessed with her. They can't stop talking about her, and she's better at using social media, including badly, than anybody else. Peter, I'll go with you first to talk about what are some of the things that we're learning about either her or about the Democratic Party as refracted through her social media.
Well, what
life
are we
so
learning
far?
About ourselves?
Ourselves.
As a wise Jedi master once said, begun these meme wars have. No, I mean, this is the future, right? This is what we are in for the rest of our lives is politics through social media memes. And it will just be trolling back and forth. And I think that, you know, that started in some ways, it started actually under Barack Obama, who was the first president to really use social media well and effectively as an organizing tool. And I think there was a lot less trolling back then. But he was the one who recognized, I think, the power of social media to rally folks, to get out messages, to go to kind of avoid traditional media gatekeepers. Mitt Romney in 2012 tried to keep up. Did a little better than he did in 2008 when he didn't even win the nomination. But still, it was pretty clear that Obama had the edge there. And then Trump came along, and Trump is entirely a creature of Twitter. He is the troll president. That's all he does. And so, you know, I think what we're really learning here is less even about Ocasio-Cortez or the Democratic Party or the future of policy or subpoena powers or any of that. Instead, we are learning that politics is going to be really reduced to and it's kind of condensed into a star, like the core of a star of. I don't know where I'm going with this metaphor here. It's like white hot memes all the time, and that's all it's going to be.
Catherine, when do you start your Instapot cooking show with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez?
Yeah, we're in talks about it right now. I think that we've had this thing, which I've even written about, that liberals are smug and conservatives are trolls. But I think a thing about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is she's a liberal troll. Like she has crossed the divide and she is just out here trolling the right. She is owning the cons every day. And, I absolutely have watched with fascination at the layers of apologies in advance for all these dumb words, but ageism, sexism, like maybe racism that have sort of popped in and out of it, right? Like the controversy over whether people are actuallying her on the internet because she's a young brown woman is, I think, you know, a legit question to ask. At the same time, you know, Reason's own Robbie Suave wrote a post that was like, hey, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has so many bad ideas. Let's just talk about her bad ideas all day. We don't need to talk about anything else. We can just talk about how bad her bad ideas are if we all want to be obsessed with her. I think that's a fair point, too. I want to talk about the Green New Deal, though, which is like the baddest bad idea. It's the perfect storm of like bad big policy idea. And that's what she's going with. Like, I, you know, you can see her sort of centering on this concept, at least in part because she recognizes that she can't really do anything in the next 2 years, right? She's going to be, she's a very, very junior Congress member, as she refers to them. And she doesn't actually have subpoena power, as she pointed out in her follow-up tweet to the very large brain tweet. But what she can do is make herself look sort of big and big thinky and above the fray. And the Green New Deal is a nightmare. It will break our country in half. Luckily, it's never going to happen.
And she has also been pressuring Democratic leadership to go in this direction as well. I mean,
yeah,
sort of joined protesters outside of Nancy Pelosi's office.
This is how I know that I'm like now an old, is because I'm like, you know, her joining protesters outside of Nancy Pelosi's office, really, come on. Like, I yield to no man in my hate for Nancy Pelosi, but like, girl, no, stop. Like,
it's, could you imagine Nancy Pelosi from her like cataract-ridden eyes? She's part of the gerontocracy. This is not a gender thing. This is totally ageism on my part. But she must look out on the world and everything
prejudice.
Is just blurry. Yeah, blurry shapes and just like, what the fuck is going on? Like, where am I? She's like, I mean, like, we're run by a series of Admiral Stockdales, like, where it's just like old people who have no fucking idea if they're alive or dead every morning.
Sadly, we're not run by a series of Admiral Akbars.
Yeah, no, Admiral
Akbar. I mean, if everybody
Admiral Akbar's warning came a little too late.
I'm not even mad, though. If everyone just turned off their hearing aids and sat quietly, like, that would be fine. That would be, the future libertarians want.
Especially if the only shapes that she can see are, like, in those slow motion black and white Teletubbies videos. that's the world that we live in.
I think that Catherine is correct in suggesting or implying, or in there is a large number of people on Twitter, conservatives mostly, who are terrified of somebody like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and that they're responding on a kind of reptilian level of like, she's young, she's foreign somehow, even though she's not, she's brown, even though she is not, she is this, she is that, she's a nightmare to a kind of conservative status quo. And they're responding to a lot of like lesser things than her ideas, which are genuinely terrible. And and she is also not the only representative of that. I mean, this is, to the extent that the Democratic Party's center is going to shift more to the left and more to kind of green politics or greenwashing every stupid fucking idea that has been tried and found wanting for the past 100 years, that they're going to greenwash it. Those ideas really need to be engaged seriously and countered.
I mean,
because for those of us who actually want to live
it. Global warming is basically progressive 9/11, right? They're just going to take every single proposal that's been out there and like put a new name on it. I mean, this is like, if you look at, you know, keep in mind that right now what the Green New Deal is, okay, first of all, we have no details, but there's going to be a committee.
No.
Guys, it's a committee. So don't worry.
And we have, like,
we'll have
one
the
of the freedoms is freedom
that always
to,
works
to
so well.
Fresh organic
always,
vegetables,
always
you know,
works.
And it's
and but also,
but
it's,
it is,
I mean, it's
it,
currently being described as this is going to be the Great Society, the moonshot, the civil rights movement of our generation. That is the scale of the ambition of this movement, the ambition that this movement is going to require. Like, this is Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on Monday, right? Like, all the cliches in a big stack handed over to a committee, which is being charged with, among other things, 100% renewable and also smart grid, which are like not compatible goals.
So this is also one of the problems with this is that's kind of the wrapper on top of stuff that is going to be put into place, which is also Medicare for All. And Peter has written widely about this, that there's no blueprint. We haven't come up with, 3D accounting yet to come up with a way to pay for this kind of stuff. So what's going to happen in the name, I think, of the Green New Deal is a bunch of really bad policy ideas that we're already kind of slowly moving towards, because the Republican Party is, they've turned their back on anything, resembling libertarian ideas. They have nothing. They're going to be pulled slightly to the left. The Democratic Party is going to be pulled slightly to the left. And the stuff that gets enacted is just stuff that is going to accelerate all of the bad trends that have been happening since 9/11, essentially. So you're going to get more state surveillance, but you're also going to get surveillance of digital media or new media, social media. You're going to get more free healthcare for more people. You're going to get more welfare for more people, et cetera. And it is disturbing to me the way that a lot of, I think, kind of right-wing trolls are bothered by AOC. They're responding in very superficial ways because they're superficial people. And the worst part of that is that allows us to misrepresent her as something deeper than
Meanwhile,
she is. Because I don't think she's the problem. I think there's a larger dynamic going on, which is that we are out of big ideas in American politics. She's putting forth a set of cliches that masquerade as big ideas that are going to be disastrous as implemented. But we need to get busy with not the moonshot. What the fuck is the opposite of a moonshot? Is it going to Mars, or is it like going deep sea diving?
It is the undersea world of Jacques Cousteau.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Joe Biden's out there just installing weather stripping in everyone's windows. That's what's actually going to be the output of the Green New Deal.
Should I go back and admit that he was right and I was wrong about recovery through retrofit? There is a report out there, people. Look it up, especially at Reason.com.
Wait, are you saying that we did recover through retrofit?
I'm thinking, maybe there was a very slow, not particularly inspiring, low-growth recovery, and maybe it was the retrofitting.
It definitely wasn't. What are you talking about? Okay, sorry. You sounded weirdly sincere there. I just had this moment where I had this like vision of you with weather stripping being like, Joe Biden was right.
No, actually, do a Reason search, and now this gives me an excuse to put the link into our thing, that there was a report out to examine how the retrofit implicated the recovery, and it like added 11 jobs in New
Hampshire
11
jobs,
for a week and a half.
But at what cost? Because you have to use your hair dryer to shrink wrap the cellophane wrap on the window mat, and then that burns more, more energy that could have been mined for Bitcoin, which could have gone up and then started the next company.
Not that there's anything wrong with any of those projects.
I installed some weather thingies in my windows, and I got to say, maybe that's why I misread you, because I feel like maybe Joe Biden was right.
You feel like you're like a better person now as a result?
No, it's just so much warmer in my house.
Oh, so you feel much worse. The interesting thing, I think, to me about the climate change movement on the left is how it actually kind of divides the left coalition, because labor is the labor movement, to the extent that it still has influence in the Democratic Party, which, even though it is declining in both size and influence, it does.
The unions are
not super on board with a lot of the kind of Green New Deal lefty environmental
decarbonizing industry is not going to be good agenda. For unions.
This is like the shift in politics that has happened, it's not even a shift yet. But I mean, the dividing line, the axis, is generational. I think it's not even ideological. And this is, I've been thinking a lot about. As Morris Fiorina, the political scientist who's written for us, a lot of us have referenced his work, we're in a period of no decision that's similar to the one in the late 19th, early 20th century. That one was solved by kind of progressivism becoming the backdrop of all of both parties. We're at a shift point. We're in a period of no decision. No party, no house, no party or no position can maintain the House, the Senate, and the White House for very long. Something is going to come that will bring a new consensus. The first shift lines or fault lines of that, I think, are generational. And this is where, younger people in general care more about it, and even to say greenness isn't quite the right thing, but it's a kind of bundle of concerns. How we solve those concerns are different, but part of it is global warming or climate change. Part of it is technology and moving forward into new technology. Part of it is universal basic income, or, you know, what do you do in a world where it seems like the gig economy is the only economy? And I don't think younger people are against that, but, you know, how do you level off so that you can actually afford stuff, or that you feel like you have a future in work? And I think a lot of older elements of both the Republican and Democratic coalitions just don't give a shit about that. And this is, you know, the people who win the next 50 years of politics, it's going to be people who I think are addressing the generational concerns of people under 40, not the Joe Biden's, Nancy Pelosi's, Hillary Clinton's, Donald Trump's of the world. Their day is done. Even as younger people won't, you know, I just wish that they would say Medicare for none. Let's rewrite, you know, the fundamental compacts that came out of the New Deal and out of the Great Depression. You know, we've got to rewrite those because we just don't live in that world anymore. And Medicare for All is a disaster. It's not even, it doesn't even work for old people, much less the whole country.
Very much looking forward to President Beto.
Speaking of people under 40 changing the world or whatever, over the weekend we had, and Robbie Suave wrote about, because he's under 40 as well, Heisman Trophy Award winner Kyler Murray was outed. It's not the right even word. He was dragged by USA Today. They went and found that the University of Oklahoma quarterback, great athlete, at the age of 14 and 15, had used the word queer a couple of times as a slur on Twitter. And since then,
in high school. In high school.
No, yeah, when he was 14 and 15 years old. Yeah. And for which he's apologized and the whole round of thing. And this comes, of course, in the wake of Kevin Hart being or uninviting himself to the Academy Awards. He self-deplatformed from the Academy Awards because 8 years ago or something like that.
Sargon could, you know, who's looking for work now, can maybe take over the Oscars.
Suderman, you think that social media is a terrifying dystopia. Does this all prove that you're right? What the living Christ is happening?
Just
here?
Memes battling forever.
We're in the white hot what?
Battle memes.
The white hot like memes. Star core. Of memes.
Okay.
That's it. No, that's it. That's our politics.
But social media provided
bullshit on Twitter.
But social media provided the raw material, but USA Today is who turned it into stupid politics. I mean, this is the oldest old school. Well, not the oldest, but it's some pretty old school.
No, they were the new school magazine. They introduced color.
They are a newspaper. Like, if we're, like, it doesn't seem fair to blame at Jack for USA Today.
So do you think...
Yeah, he had his own
yes,
tweet
he
problem
did,
over
and that
the weekend.
Was my delicious. The best tweet on that actually was Reason's former gal, Carrie Howley, who tweeted, like, the people of Myanmar are not all full of joy. I was blacklisted there and can never go back or something like that. It was just
also, like,
very...
they're normal people who experience,
who experience
she said,
a full range of human emotions.
Just like everyone except for people in Silicon Valley, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like a full range of human emotions, including currently genocide.
Yeah, sure.
So it's
I
like
I feel those
yeah.
feelings sometimes.
I well, Matt, what is your sense of things? I mean, because this, you know, with the Heisman Trophy question, and it's somebody like Kevin Hart is a little bit different because he's, you know, like the Oscars is a different type of performative show, and he's not really funny anyway, and the Oscars has got its own fucking problems. But like, do you think? Is this the beginning of a healing process almost? This is like, you know, in the terror after the French Revolution, like people are like, you know what, maybe
Wait,
there's a little bit too much blood on the floor.
Does anybody here
feel
healed?
Not.
No. Well, what I mean is the beginning of something where it's like when you're expecting a football player, in high school not to have, you know, been like, oh, that's, you're a queer bait or something like that. And, none of that is sanctioning like homophobia. It's just like, when does this end? Because it's does it end only when like Twitter is a burnt husk you know, when we sew the servers with salt like Carthage after Roman conquest or something.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like we can't, this cannot continue.
I feel like that's the short-term answer or what I would predict anyways is that Facebook and Twitter are eventually going to MySpace themselves here because it's just this isn't fun anymore. I'm probably going to
Twitter. Do you remember that those moments where like Twitter was fomenting the Arab Spring?
But also this morning we all get to rip on President Trump for tweeting about a smocking gun.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's still like, but that's what that's like the good part now, which is not great. It's still not great. I mean, I like to say smock though.
See, what I am still, and I believe it is still the case that Twitter's, you know, daily active users, at least in North America, are declining. And so, you know, maybe this is the self-correction process. And I know Catherine and Peter have both talked about this of like, if a platform, and it was in a different context, but if a platform gets so restrictive and annoying where they're banning people and they're this, people will go elsewhere. I think it's, you know, more and more it is. I talked to a couple of journalists and Twitter is very, you know, journalistic heavy and all of that kind of journalist heavy. And they're like, fuck it. It's just, it's, you know, I'm not getting anything out of it. And, you know, maybe this, you know, this will speed up the mass migration to
blogs,
you know, whatever.
Blogs, bring it back. Blogs.
The live journal
Usenet
is coming
groups.
Back. Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, you know, Tumblr was
Tumblr.
Live journal.
That's
to,
true.
Like,
finally, this was the week that Tumblr died.
I could go to.
I feel like we should talk about it. Except for then, it seems like
is Pinterest still around? Can I put up like old jokes? You know, old episodes
you
of
have
South
the
Park
for that.
I'm gonna actually start a zine and print it out and staple it together in my home
don't
office.
Don't print it out. Mimeograph
it. So I'm too young.
Hand stapler.
I know that mimeograph is a word, and I don't think I could really tell
we're
you what a.
We're the same age, and I used to like get worksheets that were mimeographed in school.
It's like a copy machine before there were copy machines.
It says like a weird. It's like a mechanical crank copy machine.
Oh, I never had that. We had a lot of technology.
Most of them were.
Seriously, though, I do want to come back to the real serious point, which like I feel like all of y'all have been squishy on at various points in our discussions over the last year, and we should all firm up our stance on like if social media platforms are bad, people can and will leave them, and new ones will emerge, and that's our answer to
or
this
maybe
problem.
New ones won't emerge, right?
And that would
and
be
maybe
okay too. We'll communicate
also
in other
fine.
Ways.
That would be
like
okay,
maybe
yeah.
we'll talk on
well,
the phone
I mean,
again.
Said
I don't
that,
know. Sounds horrible.
No, I think this isn't just a thing that is that like you can leave and like that's a possibility. It is already happening. You see the user declines in Facebook and Twitter, but you also see what caused Snapchat to rise. Now Snapchat has been a little bit sort of plateaued recently was the fact that they had their stories which disappeared, which basically solved the problem.
Not fast enough for the former Miss Kentucky.
Sure.
Of
but
course,
like,
whoever
but
the
by and large,
but
you don't get
this is an evolution.
I tweeted something
of,
when I was 14.
Right, an evolution of how social media works. What people want is the instant connection, but not the historical record in a lot of cases. And so I think we will see more of that. I also think that we will see right now we're in a world where Facebook in particular is the mega network. It's the one answer. It's the thing that everyone except me is on. And I think that we're going to see a kind of fracturing into niche networks, all of which have a different appeal and work different ways, and that in part this is going to be generational, so that you will have older people who are still on Facebook and younger people, just slightly younger people who are mostly on Twitter, and then below that you will see more and more networks, and people will be in some ways defined by what social network they're on or networks they're on and how they use them.
I'm really committed to a jitterbug
darn it.
Line here.
We don't need
so
the
I'm
jitterbug
going to say,
joke.
Yeah. Now, but when 5G happens and Jitterbug can have all of its web-based services connecting directly, then finally older people will be able to migrate to a retirement community in the sky. Nothing will stop them. Nothing will stop us.
Wait, was that a Jitterbug reference
think,
or
though,
a Logan's Run reference?
I have no... Unclear.
Well, you know, it's all kind of this. I'm pretty sure if you go back, if George Lucas redoes Logan's Run, there'll be a lot of jitterbug phones being used there.
They'll set it in Leisure World.
Having said this, and Catherine, I like the way that you're trying to, you know, say that this is the point that you were making of that, you know, the more restrictive Twitter or Facebook or any social media site gets on speech to kick people out, they will, you know, rise or flourish. One of the real problems with that is that I think what's happening now is it's not because of speech per se and things like that, but the toxic, what's coming out of all of this is like, we are going to be going through a phase of speech regulation, which we've already kind of been slowly moving into, that is just going to become more and more problematic. And I worry that in the end, if you get rid of Twitter, if you get rid of Facebook, and I don't give a shit if these particular services exist, but the real reduction is going to come in the public sphere of discussion and of talking, and that what we need to be doing is really making a full frontal argument about, no, more people should be saying more things that might be deemed offensive. And that's not to be trolling publicly or anything like that. But as a society, we need to toughen up and have conversations that we were capable of having even 5, 10, much less 20 or 30 or 40 years ago in things like television shows, in things on radio programs, and in things like the internet or social media. Because I think as long as the answer is we're just going to go elsewhere, which is a great answer, actually, but it's not going to solve these larger problems, because the politics and the ability to screw over other people that you disagree with politically or ideologically, regardless of, you know, whether social media is there or not, is not going away. And that's ultimately,
I think that's basically right. But the problem is that social media is and has it keeps proving to be a pretty bad place to have those discussions.
I think.
I
think the worst case scenario is one in which people feel that there is a single platform that is relatively free when in fact it's not free, right? This is what we have in China right now and in many places in the Middle East. We have a sort of an equilibrium where people are allowed to talk as much as they like about the personal, and where the political and, you know, to some extent, you know, certain types of outside of the mainstream identities or affiliations are in fact totally shut down. And I fear that is where we end up if we try to fight for the notion of a single platform that really is free and open in this vision that Nick paints. It's not that it's not a nice vision, but I think the risk of falling short of that and winding up with a Chinese model where something feels open but is actually closed in fundamental ways would be far, far worse than a fractured, broken, you know, Babel type scenario.
Let's pivot to our final end of show. What you have been reading and watching and otherwise snorting up your cultural nose. Suderman, you want to go first?
Yeah, I've been snorting the Coen Brothers' new movie on Netflix up my nose, I guess. My cultural nose.
You're butt chugging the Coen Brothers on Netflix. Mean,
is there a statute of limitations on butt chugging? Can we be done?
I'd be happy to find a single actual instance of it. So far, I mean, it's like razor
blades.
I'm sure
Jacob Sullum tried at least once, right?
It just feels like maybe
there's no butt chugging in the Ballad of Buster Scruggs, but it is a great, great movie that, in many ways, addresses the most consistent criticism of the Coen Brothers, which is that they're just nihilists. And
is that their most consistent criticism of the Coen Brothers?
Yeah, I mean, like, so, like, if you read my criticism, a big argument that has been advanced against these guys is that they are just nihilists who don't believe anything means anything. And I actually think it's a misreading. I think that they sort of are, they're nihilism curious, and they include sort of nihilistic themes in a lot of their movies, but
they're in favor of a market-based healthcare reform plan.
I think we could start it
no
to just not curious.
Like,
but
that.
In the end, they're really like deeply humanistic filmmakers who say that, like, the world doesn't provide meaning, it doesn't make sense, it isn't ordered. What our job is to do as humans is to find some way to do that for ourselves anyway. And that is the kind of thematic, that is a short version of the kind of thematic merry-go-round. What am I that like the whole movie revolves around in, which is a series of vignettes set kind of in the Old West. Anyway, it's great. It's on Netflix. And if you like the Coen brothers at all, or good movies in general, or funny, strange sort of literary productions, you should definitely watch it.
Can I, Matt, I don't have moderator's prerogative or anything, but I just wanted to ask Peter really quickly, and also what you guys think. You know, the sign that the Coen brothers have gone to Netflix in order to tell a story and things like that. I mean, do you feel that that is not only where the most interesting stuff is showing up, but consistently the most interesting producers and creators of kind of narrative art are seeking out places like Netflix and Amazon or alternatives to kind of traditional studio models or
so it is happening models. And it's happening in part because Netflix has literally too much money. They have something like $8 or $9 billion for their production budget. And it's basically the situation that the stimulus was in, which is they have to spend all of this money. And so they are doing two things. They're buying up a lot of stuff that is total crap. I mean, like the Cloverfield paradox, and just taking stinkers off the market for studios. And you can say that's less true, but still true to some extent with Mowgli, their Jungle Book film that just that they bought from a studio that had developed it for a bunch of years, and it looked like it was going to be a mess, and so they just sort of handed it off to Netflix, and the studio was made whole. And then Netflix doesn't sell tickets in a traditional sense. They have been for a few films this year, in part because of Ballad of Buster Scruggs, Roma, which is going to debut on Netflix next week, but has already been in some theaters. These are kind of big Oscar contenders. So I think yes, that is true to some extent, but it's in part just because of the weird economics of a startup where their strategy is to outspend everyone and become the dominant platform, so that no one feels like they can live without Netflix.
Catherine, what have you been consuming?
At the urging of Ron Bailey, I am reading Nick Harkaway's Gnomon, or Gnomon, as it is spelled. And
I think this was a pick of mine just a couple of months ago. Oh, yeah? I certainly read it earlier this year.
So Ron used it as the theoretical frame for his cover story in this month's issue about the rise of the algocracy, the rule by algorithm. And he found the portrait of a surveillance society reimagined and informed by current AI and facial recognition technology to be terrifying and believable. So much so, in fact, that last week internally we had a lively debate about whether Ron Bailey was maybe ready to ban certain types of technology, which
unbelievable.
And we're going to talk more about that possibly on a podcast, definitely in our pages. But I strongly recommend it. If Peter already recommended it, then I simply endorse his recommendation, because it is a Neil Stephenson-esque without quite so much frippery novel. And it has a lot of good ideas. One of the Amazon reviews just says, "This book made me feel dumb, period. I love it, period," which is about right.
Fun fact about Nick Harkaway, he is the son of spy novelist John Le Carré.
No.
Yep.
Oh, my God.
It's two Le Carré references in one show. Nick, what have you been Le Carré-ing?
I am reading Joel Waldfogel's, he's an economist, Digital Renaissance, What Data and Economics Tell Us About the Future of Popular Culture. And it's essentially a data-rich update of a story that I published in Reason in 98 or 99 about cultural proliferation. But it's looking at what happens when the cost to produce and consume culture go way, way down, and the ability to regulate both through taste as well as through, you know, law or copyright law and things like that happen. And I'm only partway through it, but it's fascinating just to look at whether or how did Napster and digital file sharing, how did it actually affect the recording industry? Are the real stories that it just destroyed everything true or not? How does something similar, the ability to download movies for free, did that change things, or how did it change things? So it's Digital Renaissance by Joel Waldfogel. Very interesting.
And speaking of music, my recommendation here is, or what I've been consuming is last night or the night before, I rewatched Walk the Line, the Johnny Cash biopic, for the first time since it came out, and was surprised to see how much I enjoyed it upon rewatching. But then it led me down a great rabbit hole of telling my Alexa device to play a bunch of Johnny Cash tunes. And like all music biopics, and I think like a lot of the way that we look at, especially the kind of rise of Sun Studios music, Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, Elvis Presley et al., the backup bands just don't get the love that they deserve. The Tennessee Three, and all these kind of like just one electric guitar, one stand-up bass, and one really simple snare drums, that sound is phenomenal, and people don't give enough credit to the backing band. So shout out to the Tennessee Three and all similarly situated bands from the early 50s, and go and bend your ear towards Elvis's backup band, all those guys. Amazing, super simplistic in an almost Kraftwerk style way of minimalism, and it's great and makes me really excited to be alive. And that's all the excitement to be alive we have time for here on the Reason Podcast. Editors Roundtable Edition. Tune in all week as we have other fresh content, and Lord knows what kind of weird things are going to drop between now and then and next Monday. But until then, I wish you all a happy December and such. Goodbye.